order.
I was going to send him an
email. Stand
for
the flag salute. I pledge allegiance
to the flag,
of the United States of America,
and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God,
indivisible,
with liberty and justice for all.
May we have the roll call?
Councilmember Deedy?
Here.
Councilmember Oglesby?
Here.
Councilmember Wisnowski?
Here.
Councilmember Stout? I haven't heard from her, Mayor. So maybe she'll be joining late. Councilmember Nelson?
Here.
Councilmember Page?
Here.
Okay, we have a quorum.
So who's Sean Carey?
He's your new superintendent.
He's what?
The new school superintendent. Say hi, Sean.
I'm the superintendent of Enumclaw Schools.
Oh, you're the new superintendent. Oh, yes. Sorry.
That's okay. Unfamiliar face, I know.
Okay, so this meeting is going to be to discuss school impact fees, and that's why Sean Carey's here. And David is going to be leading the discussion. He has some information to share with us.
Thank you, Mayor. Thanks everyone for carving off some time for this important topic. I know that many of you have been waiting quite a while to get this project really kicked off in a formal way. Thankfully, we have the technology now to be able to have a meeting like this and hopefully get everyone up to speed and answer everyone's questions. You know, this is intended to be kind of a formal council kickoff for this discussion of school impact fees. So please feel free to discuss as I'm going through. Don't let me just freight train through to the end. So if you have questions, just, you know, holler or raise your hand. And if I don't see you, maybe the mayor can interrupt me or Brenda, somebody can cut me off and we can get to some questions. Otherwise, I'll just kind of keep going. So I'm going to share my screen. Hopefully everyone can see the slides there.
Yep.
Yeah, we can see your slides, David.
Great. So, make sure this is gonna work there. Okay, so purpose of our meeting tonight, talk about an overview of a proposed school impact fee program for the city of Black Diamond. I'll cover the steps that it would take to get from here to a final adoption. We'll cover the timing, how that process would work. We'll cover some specific circumstances, including how a school impact fee program would affect our MPDs, our master plan developments, which, as you may know, have separate school mitigation requirements already built into them. And then final topic, and the one that we may spend the most time on, would be some of the key decisions that the council would need to make. A lot of the school impact fee program regulations are established in state law. So many of the things there's not a lot of flexibility on, but there are some important things that cities do have a lot of flexibility on. So we'll spend some time talking about what are the items that individual cities can do to tailor a school impact fee program to local needs. So first and foremost, I'm going to kind of start at the beginning, and I apologize for those of you who this is too elementary, but I just thought I'd kind of start with the basics and get more detail from there. So what are impact fees? They are a mechanism for financing new school facilities to serve new growth, to serve new residents. It's a tool provided by the Growth Management Act. There are some RCWs that specifically lay out what you can and can't do with impact fees. They are charged, this is important, they're only charged on new residential development. So anybody currently living in Black Diamond in their current house, this doesn't affect them. It's only when new construction comes on board that you have impact fees that come up. And the theory behind all of this is to help growth pay for growth. If you're gonna have new people, new students coming into the school district, the idea is that growth needs to help offset the costs of serving those new students.
David?
Yes.
That also includes not just new development, but if you add on to your home, right? Anything that's new construction?
If it doesn't generate additional students, if it doesn't create new demand on the school system, the idea is that it shouldn't. So just, you know, adding on a kitchen or a new bedroom or something like that, that wouldn't apply. It's only new construction that creates new demand for school services.
Okay.
So the next topic is what can impact fees be used for? So as I mentioned, the idea behind impact fees is to help schools pay for the costs of new capital facilities. They're called system improvements in the statutory language. And those new facilities have to be reasonably related to the new development. You can't, it needs to be kind of tied to the growth that's happening. It can't be something that is just fixing a pre-existing deficiency or pre-existing problem in the school facility. So you can build new schools, you can expand existing schools to accommodate more students, you can buy portables. I think there's a number of different ways that you can do that. Can go for property acquisition, and it pays not just for the school building, but for associated athletic fields and other amenity facilities, capital facilities, as well as some capital equipment.
So I have one more question.
Yes.
So once impact fees are received, Dr. Carey, you could probably answer as well, that the school has a limited amount of time to use it, right? So it doesn't just keep carrying over for an indefinite time. They have a structured amount of time that they use it. And then if they don't use it, where does that money go? If they fail to use it in a proper amount of time, where does that money go back to, or what happens with it?
Yeah, so I'll take the first crack, and Dr. Carey or any other school person who's on the line, feel free to jump in. But the statutes give you a 10-year window for the schools to pay for facilities out of the fees that have been collected. So it's kind of a rolling 10-year calendar, essentially, on the dollars that come in. There is a mechanism where schools, if they find it, and I think the language in the statute is a compelling need or an extraordinary and compelling need, something like that, where they could try to justify why 10 years may not be long enough if there's a particular project. But generally, it's a 10-year window. And then our ordinance, the draft ordinance that I circulated, also includes a refund provision where once that 10-year window has expired, if there's money that hasn't been spent within that 10 years, there's a process where the person who paid in can try to reclaim the money that was paid in.
Okay. Very well said. Yes, that's exactly the way I understand it as well.
All right, great. Thank you.
So as I mentioned, one thing that school impact fees cannot be used for is to address pre-existing deficiencies. So if there's currently capacity for, I'm just going to make up random numbers, if there's currently capacity for 1,000 students, but there are actually 1,200 students enrolled, that those extra 200 students are kind of creating a pre-existing deficiency. Impact fees can't go towards fixing current problems. They have to be reasonably related to new growth. And the impact fees cannot be the sole source of funds for building new facilities. It can only be a portion. There has to be some additional source of funds. So how do impact fees work? That's kind of a broad question, but this is kind of the general overview of the process. First, a school district has to demonstrate that it's eligible and has a need. It demonstrates that need by providing a capital facilities plan that lays out what projections are going to be for student populations, for growth, and the capacity of the existing facilities to accommodate those students. Another step is that the city has to actually adopt an impact fee program ordinance. So even though it's the schools that are the ones building the facilities and using the money, it's actually the cities that actually impose the fees and collect them. Once the impact fee program has been adopted, schools can propose impact fee amounts based on the data that they've collected and the formulas that are in place for translating those that data into dollars, needed dollars in order to build facilities. Based on those proposals and the formulas, the city can then determine the amount to be collected for new residential development within each district. So because Black Diamond is a city with multiple school districts serving it, there would be a separate impact fee for each particular district. The city would then collect the impact fees. That's usually done at the building for permit stage for new development. We'll talk later, there's some ways that can be deferred a bit, but that's the general rule. Then the city would then remit those fees that it has collected to the school districts at regular intervals. I think we're contemplating a monthly process here. And that's done through a contract, an interlocal agreement between the school districts and the cities that spells out how the city is going to collect and remit those fees. Then, as you mentioned, Councilmember Deedy, school districts have to spend the impact fees on eligible improvements within 10 years, unless they can show a compelling need for a longer period. School districts have to account for their use of the impact fees collected from the city. They do that through annual reporting, and those impact fees are also updated annually as data change, as projections change, and as facilities are built and retired.
David, is that calculation process the same for each of the four schools? Is there like a state formula, or how do we calculate the amount?
So I'll walk you through that a little bit more in a bit, but just okay. Generally, there is a widely approved and adopted formula that is common to many school districts, perhaps almost all school districts. That formula can be tweaked a bit, but that's generally a formula that's in place, and then the districts are just required to kind of plug their own data into the formula. So that, you know, the formula doesn't always yield the same result because it depends on what data goes into it, but the overall concept of the formula is the same.
I wanted to announce that Aaron just logged on.
Oh, great.
Welcome, Aaron.
Hello, Councilmember Stout.
Hi, sorry to be late.
No worries.
Thanks,
so in the previous slide, I talked about one of the first steps is demonstrating eligibility. The school district has to demonstrate its need and eligibility for impact fees. So how do they do that? Districts are much like cities. They're governed and have to comply with the Growth Management Act. And one of the things that districts do is they prepare capital facilities plans, just like cities do every year. And those capital facilities plans are where the city or where the school district determines what its existing capacities and facilities are, what its projections for growth are going to be within the district, and what kind of facilities may need to be built in order to accommodate that growth. There's what are called grade spans. So, and I'm not an expert in this. I don't really know how to explain this very well, but schools identify how they cluster grades of students. So they compare their six-year enrollment projections for those grade spans to determine, I guess, sort of to compare what they expect to need to what their current facilities can accommodate. Districts have level of service standards, just like cities do. And so each district adopts its own level of service standards to help determine you know, how much they're going to provide in terms of facilities for their students as an objective to measure their progress against. And based on those projections and their capital facilities plans, they identify projects that would be needed to address any needs that are identified in those plans. And just like in a city, that's kind of a six-year planning period that cities have for our transportation improvement program and our own capital facilities planning works very much the same way for school districts. And those capital facilities plans are then provided to cities every year in order for cities to be able to sort of evaluate what those plans look like and to see the justification for the impact fees that are being proposed by the various districts. Each city has to, Councilmember Deedy.
I might be a little out of order, but I know we were talking several times in finance when I was on the finance committee that we were, you know, receiving all the impact fees from 10 trails. And we had discussed about instead of having it come to the city and then we transfer it to the school, have it just go directly to the school. Is that an option or is that not a good idea? Because I see that we're talking about still having the city collect it, and maybe the council would charge some sort of small fee for maintaining, for doing that, and then transferring it over to the school. It, mm-hmm. I think it would be less cumbersome if it just went from the builder mm-hmm. to the school, or is it better to have that tracking where the city tracks and knows exactly what the funds are, and then they transfer it to the school? I don't know.
So that's a big topic. There's a lot we could talk about there. And I will go into some of that a little bit more, but at a high level, recall that our MPDs, 10 trails, are subject to a completely separate comprehensive school mitigation agreement. So even though it kind of looks like impact fees, it's not really, it's targeted mitigation that's kind of separate and apart from what would be provided in a statutory impact fee program like this would be. So there's a lot more room in that kind of a negotiated agreement as part of a master plan development to customize how that relationship between the city and the district works. I haven't really thought about, but I think it would be pretty complicated and perhaps not even feasible to cut the middleman out in a school impact fee program like what we're talking about here, because the whole mechanism for monitoring and collecting impact fees is done through the city. School districts wouldn't really have a way to know when new building applications are coming in, be able to evaluate exemptions on a case-by-case basis. So I wouldn't foreclose that from ever being possible, but I'm not sure that there's any mechanism contemplated in the law to allow that to happen.
Okay.
So David, I was going to say that it's also part of the permitting process. So it would make it complicated if it was paid to the school first, and they would have to have some way to let us know that they paid it so that we could issue the permit. So it would make it more complicated.
Yeah, so it sounds like it would make more sense just for the city to collect it and then the city to give a report to the school district on what impacts, what homes have been or businesses have been built. And then there would be that tracking through the city and then that tracking through the school, and everybody would be on the same page, right?
Yeah, definitely. And Denise, if you're around and available, if you have any thoughts you care to share either now or down the road about if there's any, I'm not aware of any other cities that have cut themselves out of the middle of the school impact fee loop, but if you've ever seen that or heard of that done, I'm happy to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I'll just really quickly add, I think you all have touched on the key points in terms of it being a part of the permitting system and having it tied to that process so that the city does determine exemptions and things of that nature. Early on when impact fees were new in our state in the 90s, jurisdictions who had initially adopted school impact fee ordinances, there were some that actually did have the builder going first to the school district and paying the fee. And the feedback that those jurisdictions heard is that builders very much prefer a one stop. They want to be able to just go in and pay all of their permit fees at one time. And so what we found early on is that those cities who had initially said go to the school district to pay ended up changing their procedure to send it back to the city.
Thank you, Denise. Helpful. Good perspective. So back to our slide. Like I mentioned before, school districts.
Pardon. I think there was a question from Councilmember Oglesby.
Oh, okay. Sorry, missed that one.
No worries. So I just have a question regarding, when you're talking about an extra job within the city flow of our employees, when we're talking about the community development and the permitting section, how much more workload are we looking at for our city staff? Is it something that we need to look forward in our budgeting system to add another employee for this? Is it something very small that they can add into their normal daily work? How does that workload, I mean, maybe that makes more of a management question for Carol, or maybe Barb. I'm just wondering how much more extra workload we need financially for our city staff.
Probably none, because they're collecting them now for the MPDs, and they would just be adding another level of a fee that would go through the permitting process. So probably none. Probably would be no little impact.
So it would Councilmember, there's just FYI, I think the largest, if there is an additional burden imposed, it's probably just on the accounting side of things, having extra accounts to keep track of and being able to funnel those. But like the mayor said, we're already collecting school mitigation fees on the MPDs, and this is a similar process. Yes, Councilmember Dean.
So we would just have to look at, the council would have to look at making an application fee. So when somebody comes in and puts an application in for a new business or home, we add a small fee for the school impact, right?
So another slide we'll get to, one of the choices that the council will eventually need to make is whether to have an administrative fee for processing the school impact fees, and also potentially a fee on the deferral program. But we'll get to that in a subsequent slide.
Okay.
So as I was mentioning, the capital facilities plans, they're reviewed by the King County School Technical Review Committee, and they have been provided to the cities on an annual basis as well, so that the cities can do an annual review of the impact fees and see if they need to be adjusted based on the data and information provided by school districts. As you know, in the city of Black Diamond, there are four school districts that serve our population. The lion's share of it is from the Enumclaw School District, but Tahoma has the east side of Lake Sawyer primarily. The Kent School District has the west side of Lake Sawyer, and Auburn has a small corner in the southwest part of the city. So that means there would have to be a separate impact fee for each district. Yes.
So has the city heard from the other school districts? I know we've heard extensively from the Enumclaw School Board through emails and such and work studies, but I haven't, that I remember, received any emails from Tahoma or the Kent or Auburn about having impact fees for them at all. So has there been any discussion with the mayor or anybody else?
I'll let Denise and the mayor chime in on that, but I have had a recent discussion just through email with the Kent School District, just having provided them the latest package of information and letting them know that this was being considered. But I'll let Denise and the mayor chime in on the status of any discussions they've had with the other school districts.
So I'll just add, and I apologize, when I spoke before, I didn't introduce myself. Denise Stiffarm, and I'm legal counsel for Enumclaw School District, but also for Tahoma School District and Auburn School District on this matter. So I have worked with all three of the districts over the years on their capital facilities plans and impact fee matters. Your council has probably seen me the most for Enumclaw School District. I will note that Bob Kenworthy, who is the Assistant Director of Capital Projects, is on the Zoom tonight here for Auburn School District. Lori Cloud from Tahoma was going to try to make it. I'm not sure if she was able to jump on or not, but what I can say for these three school districts is they very much are interested in the city's consideration of a school impact fee ordinance. They, in their other jurisdictions, they have impact fee ordinances in place, and so this would round that out.
Okay.
Great, thank you. So this, Councilor Wisnowski, you asked earlier about how the calculations happen. So I've included here just an excerpt from, I just picked Tahoma School District at random. Well, not really random. They had a nice concise little paragraph that I could clip out of their capital facilities plan. So I just popped it in here. And this kind of describes, I won't read this all to you, but it describes the methodology and the variables used to calculate the impact fees. You'll notice there's a reference to a formula adopted by King County Ordinance Number 10162, and then also part of the King County Code. That formula has been widely adopted throughout many school districts, and it lays out a very thorough way of analyzing the various components of what would go into a school impact fee. They are calculated based on dwelling units, classifications of either single family or multifamily, and they incorporate both the costs of acquiring property, engineering, construction, and the actual sort of build out of the facility. So all of that sort of goes in. And then the standard, we'll talk about this a little bit more later, but the King County ordinance includes, you'll see here, a 50% discount rate. Basically, that's kind of considered, each district will consider what it calls a local share. 50%, I'm not really sure where that number originally came from, if that was sort of a compromise or a ballpark or approximation, how that number came about. But you'll see from the next slide that I have here, this is the actual impact fee calculation that Tahoma is using for its 2020 to 2025 capital facilities plan. And you'll see down at the very bottom, and I apologize if the numbers are a little bit squished on this, but you'll see at the bottom, the second to the last line says fee as calculated. There's a single family line of $11,495 and a multifamily line of $8,732. And you'll see below that a 50% local share. And it's that local share that the districts are actually asking cities to impose. So the idea, as I mentioned before, is that impact fees aren't allowed to pay for 100% of all system improvements. But so this 50% number, I'm not sure exactly how that came about, but that seems to be the widely accepted, commonly adopted local share percentage. And it is, I think it's consistent across the four school districts that serve Black Diamond with the other cities that have imposed, you know, with City of Auburn and City of Kent and Maple Valley and the other cities in the area that those same school districts serve.
Question.
Yes.
So seeing these fees and the fee calculation and stuff and thinking about what we're doing still in the Black Diamond, we're still doing studies on what we need, like how many homes we need, single homes, double homes. We're doing that study right now, right? How does that affect, if that study's not done yet, how does that affect these fees or do those two work together?
Well, they're really kind of separate. They're separate items because I think the study that you're referring to is a land use planning study that would kind of determine, you know, what is the city's capacity to accommodate new residents?
Right.
What parts of the cities do zoning regulations need to be adjusted to best accommodate a mix of housing?
Right.
These calculations don't reflect anything about the cost of housing or the mix of housing. These calculations reflect the school district's estimated costs of building schools and the related capital equipment that goes with those schools. So if you'll see from this chart that's up on the slide right now, again, the numbers are in the lettering is a little bit small, but there's site acquisition costs with data assumptions built in. There's school construction costs. There's temporary facilities costs. I think those are things like portable buildings and other temporary locations before those were replaced. Then there's various components of state funding where state money kicks in. There's property tax estimates that kick in. And so it's when you combine all of those things into their formula, the idea is to come up with how much of the cost of building new facilities isn't going to be covered by the existing funding sources of property taxes and state state funding.
Okay. Question, David.
Yes.
Does the formula take into account either senior housing or low income housing? I would think a great way to incentivize the building of low income housing would be to lower some of the fees on that. Same around senior housing, right?
We'll have a slide that will talk about that. That will be one of the key policy considerations that the council gets to kind of put its own stamp on. But in terms of the actual impact fee calculation, those are based on estimated student generation factors. So there's all kinds of data that schools use that say, okay, the average new family, single family home generates so many students over a population average. The average apartment generates so many students for that school district. These are, again, not really trying to influence what types of houses or what types of housing gets built. This is just, if something gets built, how many students does it generate? And what kind of costs do we need to build in to be able to accommodate those new, that new influx of students? So, but good questions, and we'll get to that low-income housing and other ways of incentivizing accommodations like that.
Thank you.
So here's a summary chart based on the final adopted 2020 capital facilities plans from the four school districts. These are the numbers that each of the four districts are requesting from the city. You'll notice that each school district has both a single family and a multifamily number. These numbers are the result of running their own local data through the formulas to arrive at these numbers. One thing that may stand out to you is that number from Auburn, the multifamily number, and why is it so large? And I'm happy to have anybody who's on the call from the school district or Denise can address it as well. But I think the general understanding there is that due to very locally specific circumstances in Auburn and Federal Way, a great deal of the new housing going in down there is technically multifamily, but they're large multifamily. There's a lot of 3 and 4 bedroom townhomes that generate just as many students as large, 2,500, 3,000 square foot houses do. And for whatever reason, the housing mix down there in those cities just seems to generate a lot of students out of multifamily. And so crunching their own local data through the formula creates this big number. I think, and I don't have firsthand knowledge, but I'm sure Denise can explain if there's a story to be told, but my understanding is that the council there was not thrilled with the way that number turned out, and so they adopted kind of a sliding scale of discounts so that a smaller multifamily dwelling, a one-bedroom apartment, received a big discount off of the formula-derived fee. A two-bedroom townhome would pay a little bit more, all the way up to full freight for a 4-bedroom or larger townhome. So that kind of gives you some sense of the range of fees that we're talking about here, as well as a city's ability to apply some discretion into what those numbers ultimately look like. Yes, Councilmember Deedy.
So just off the top of my head, just thinking about if we did something like this, but on the flip side, we don't want to discourage building, right? But it sounds like the city of Auburn is trying to discourage 4 bedrooms or larger, correct, rooms?
I don't think there's any, I don't know that discouraging is really the issue. I think it's more just making sure that the growth that comes in pays for the impacts that it's going to have on the school districts.
So we have, we have 10 trails building apartments and of course townhomes, and they're already in their own fee schedule for impact. And then I know we have another developer looking at building a couple other apartments within the city. I mean, I think it's a good idea to have some sort of scaling rate versus like what Auburn did with, you know, your studio or one bedroom or two bedroom. And then if you're building a four bedroom, which like you said, brings in a larger family, would be good. So I think for the council, it's worth looking at what the Auburn, what the city council in Auburn did on this, just because of the knowledge of knowing that there's more apartments coming.
Yeah.
I would say that a 6,000 feet for over $6,000 for a studio apartment seems kind of high, because I wouldn't think much, most studio apartments would have much impact on a school, but maybe I'm used to New York City as studio apartments.
And Dr. Carey had to excuse himself, so I hope everything is okay.
I think he had another meeting to get to, so I'll be sure to fill him in for what he has left on here. But I will just touch really quick on this discussion, and I'll also note that Cindy Blansfield, who is the Associate Director of Business and Operations at the Auburn School District, actually did join us. So she is here as well as Bob Kenworthy, and they may want to add something here. But the school districts every year update the numbers that go into the formula, and that includes that student generation rate to see what is, you know, the trend for new dwelling units being built. And as David mentioned, in both Auburn and in Federal Way, they just have a lot of larger units being built and a lot of students living in those units. So that's what's generating that per dwelling unit impact for multifamily that is much higher than single family. So really in those districts, they have more students living in an apartment than students living in a single family home. And so that's what's generating that. It is an average over all of the multifamily units built within the previous 5-year period, and then it's updated every year. So it may in future years look different. It might look more like the other school districts, but just right now in this moment, and it's been going on for about 4 years now, that's what's happening.
Great. All right, thank you, Denise. How do we get from where we are today to having a fully functioning impact fee program? Here's the steps that we would go through. Number one, the first step is that the city would need to incorporate each of the school district's capital facilities plans into the city's own comprehensive plan. There is actually a Planning Commission public hearing scheduled on August the 11th to consider just that very thing. So currently our Black Diamond Comprehensive Plan has a generic reference to the school capital facilities plans. It says something to the effect of, you know, the city adopts and incorporates the capital facilities plans of the Auburn, Enumclaw, Kent, and Tahoma school districts. But we really need to have a more specific reference incorporating the current capital facilities plans, because those plans are continuously being updated every year. We need to do the same thing with our own comp plan to make sure that that we do all this in a valid and defensible and procedurally correct way. So first thing we'll have to do is update our own comp plan to incorporate by reference each of the district's own capital facilities plans. If the Planning Commission submits a recommendation to do that, that will be on your agenda for the August 20th council meeting. Doing that in August, we would have to do that as what's called an emergency ordinance. The Growth Management Act doesn't let us just amend our comp plan anytime willy-nilly whenever we want. The Growth Management Act contemplates an annual update process of the comp plan, but it allows for exceptions for urgent situations. And if the council is concerned that lots of buildings going on in the city, and we want to make sure that as much of that building as possible is contributing to the development and the funding of new school resources, new school facilities, the sooner we can get it adopted, the better, because otherwise the districts are losing the opportunity to collect those fees. So So we could consider that as an emergency ordinance and have it adopted on 820. That would clear the first step in getting the impact fee program in place. The second step would be then to adopt the impact fee program ordinance. And you all got a copy of that, of a draft version of that. We have a public hearing scheduled on August 6th to take public input on the draft ordinance. That ordinance lays all the ground rules, incorporates all the state mandated requirements, sets definitions, sets all kinds of rules and processes for collecting impact fees. So that would be another step, and that could be, like I said, we have a public hearing on the 6th on that. If the council was ready to proceed, it could be voted on and adopted also on the 20th at the same time that the comprehensive plan is updated. The third step would be to pass an impact fee resolution. The program ordinance in step two establishes the framework, gives you the formula, creates the legal authority to collect them, but you would actually need to then adopt a fee resolution that would set the fee for each school district for both single and multifamily. It could impose any administrative costs, administrative fees that we want to include. It could include any sort of policy tweaking, Councilmember Deedy, like you were discussing. That would be the place where the actual fee number gets incorporated into the city fee schedule and says, okay, builder, this is the fee you're gonna pay starting on today. And then the last step, the fourth step, would be to execute an agreement, an interlocal agreement, an ILA with each of the four school districts, and that governs how the money gets passed back and forth and kind of who's going to do what as between the school district versus the city. And the ordinance, as it's drafted right now, the ordinance in step two says that the effective date or the ability to start collecting impact fees doesn't kick in until that interlocal agreement with each district is signed, because we're not going to collect money without an agreement. It's what we're going to do with it. So we want to have that in place as well. So that's the four steps. And I would just note, as I mentioned at the bottom, step one and step three are going to be sort of an annual update. It's going to be something you're going to be, this isn't set and forget, you know, it's going to be annually updated. So each year the school districts are going to send us an updated capital facilities plan. We would then need to incorporate that in our annual docketing process, incorporate that new plan into the city's own comp plan every year, just it would be on a cycle, a regular cycle. And then if there are any changes to the proposed impact fees, we would need to update step three, update the fee resolution with whatever the new numbers are. So again, that would be a once a year thing. Okay, big question, since you know our master plan developments are a large part of the growth in the city, folks are gonna be curious how the impact fee program affects the MPD. Both the 10 Trails and the Lawson Hills MPD lie entirely within the Enumclaw School District. So the only effect that the impact fee program would have would be through whatever fees we adopt for Enumclaw. The Enumclaw School District worked very closely with the city and the developer from the very beginning on figuring out how school mitigation was going to work, because everyone acknowledged we didn't have an impact fee program in place. We knew it would create a lot of impacts. Needed to be some sort of understanding in place, particularly since the school mitigation agreement wasn't just going to cover things like fees. It was going to involve setting aside property, specific lots, as you know, property where schools could be built and sited. And so that comprehensive school mitigation agreement went into effect in January of 2011. And so since development has been underway, the city has been collecting what are called school mitigation fees, which are much like impact fees, for all the development that's going on. As you'll see in a minute, the city is currently able to collect $7,783 per single family unit and $2,502 per multifamily unit within 10 Trails under the existing CSMA. So even if there was no impact fee ordinance ever adopted, the city would still be able to collect at least those amounts and pass those on to the Enumclaw School District. if the city were to adopt a school impact fee program and adopt the fees that are being currently proposed by the school district, then here's what would happen. And I'm just going to kind of read through some of this because it's fairly detailed. The city's school impact fee ordinance would not apply at all to the residential dwelling units located within the city of Black Diamond. Wouldn't apply to anything within 10 trails, but would apply otherwise to the city of Black Diamond. So, but anything that's inside the NPD, the impact fee ordinance does not apply to, because the school mitigation agreement covers all of that. However, just because that the impact fee ordinance doesn't apply to 10 trails, it does affect 10 trails, because the CSMA fees, by the language of the agreement, automatically adjust to equal the amount of the impact fees imposed by the city, so long as those fees fall under the ceiling and above the floor of the fees that are set within the CSMA. So right now, the Comprehensive School Mitigation Agreement says that those fees charged under the CSMA equal those of the school impact fee, so long as if they are at least $7,783 per single family unit and $2,502 per multifamily unit, and so long as they are no more than $12,453 for a single family unit and $4,003 for a multifamily unit. So I'm gonna scroll down so you can see that. So this is section 9.2 of the CSMA. The little part that I've highlighted here is that the mitigation fee shall be the rate adopted by the City of Black Diamond School Impact Fee or School Mitigation Fee Ordinance, if any, provided that the maximum fee for each dwelling unit shall be $12,453 for single family, $4,000 for multifamily, but in no event, even in the absence of a school mitigation fee, school impact fee, the mitigation fee shall be less than $7,783 per single family and $2,502 for multifamily. So again, it's setting a floor and a ceiling. As long as the city adopts an impact fee, citywide impact fee that's within that floor and that ceiling, then it will automatically apply to the NPD. So for 2020, the Union Claw School District is proposing $8,972 for a single family residence and $6,282 for a multifamily residence. So under the CSMA, the impact fees for building within the MPDs would be $8,972 for single family, but $4,003 for the multifamily, because that's the maximum we're allowed to charge under the CSMA for multifamily is $4,000.
So David, it looks like Ms. Stout has her hand up.
Yes, Councilmember Stout.
Thank you. Maybe you just answered this, but I kind of got lost in the shuffle there. With the 50% discount, does that number qualify for the MPDs or whatever the actual ordinance?
The fees, the $8,972 and the $6,282 that Enum Claw is proposing, those incorporate the 50% discount. So that is the 50% discounted number. So under the 2020 fee proposal from Enum Claw, within the NPD, we would be charging the recommended single family rate, but we would be charging less than the recommended multifamily rate because of the limitation of $4,003 under the CSMA for multifamily. In the future, MPD residential units could be charged as high as $12,453 for a single family and $4,003 for a multifamily, but only if the city adopts an impact fee ordinance and the district's recommended impact fees are calculated at those rates or higher. So if sometime in the future the district's impact fees goes way up, we can go up as well, as long as we don't go over $12,453 within the MPD. And so the school impact fee ordinance, if the city adopts one, that would ensure that all new development located within the city is providing mitigation for schools. We just went through that. So here are some key decisions for the council to consider. As I mentioned, a lot of the provisions of the draft ordinance that I circulated, and we'll look at those in a minute, a lot of those are pretty well defined by state law and we don't have much wiggle room. But there are a number of places where there is some wiggle room and where the council gets to make some discretionary calls. So here are four things that council can probably focus the bulk of their attention on. Exemptions and waivers to the impact fee ordinance. I'll go through these specifically in just a moment, but the state law allows cities to adopt impact fee exemptions or waivers for low-income housing. And there's rules behind that, and I'll walk you through those. And another thing that you could consider, and I know that Ms. Kincaid had reminded me that ADUs are kind of on top of people's mind in Black Diamond, and the draft ordinance didn't address ADUs. So one thing that the council could do if it wanted to would be to incorporate ADUs as one of the exemptions for impact fees. Another area of discretion for the council would be the administrative fees. We talked about this briefly, that the city has administration and accounting costs that go with just with tracking and collecting and forwarding on the impact fees to the school district. So there could be a fee imposed for that. And then one thing that we haven't talked about, but one thing we will, is there's a way that a builder can defer the timing of the collection of the impact fees. And if the council were to, well, state law requires that the city provide deferral as an option. So the deferral does create some additional administrative burdens. And so there could be a cost that it gets imposed for that invoking the deferral option. The deferral option gives builders a few different choices for when to delay the collection of the impact fees. The draft ordinance that you've received says that rather than paying the impact fees at the time of the issuance of the building permit, a developer can delay paying until the final inspection of the dwelling unit. That's pretty standard. I think that's the deferral option that most cities provide. But there are two other options that you can provide instead. One would be to defer collection until certificate of occupancy is issued, or you can defer collection until the first sale of the new construction. And that is that payment comes out of the seller's proceeds, usually I think through escrow. So we'll talk through some of those options as well. And then finally, one of the other discretionary decisions that the council can consider is that local share. This I think is probably less relevant here because all the four school districts in our district, I believe, are requesting that the 50% local share be adopted. As I said, that's quite standard. That's the most common. And it might be difficult or problematic if one school district was, you know, only being hit with a 25% discount and others were getting 50, you know, you probably don't want to vary that among school districts serving the same population. So you may not want to mess with that, but that is something that some cities do.
So David?
Yes.
So under the 3.70.110 exemptions, on number three, it says any form of housing for elderly, including nursing homes and retirement centers, any type of housing units that have recorded covenants or a recorded declaration of restrictions precluding school-aged children as residents in those units. So what if you, I'll give an example, I'll use her as an example. So Ms. McCain built a garage with a living quarters up above for her, for an elderly family member. Mm-hmm. And so then she would be exempt from that, right? From the fees. But then let's just say sometime later, it's then used for, you know, somebody who isn't elderly. Mm-hmm. then can the city go back and get the impact fees or not? You know, I don't quite understand that part.
Yeah. Of
how you can go back and say, okay, now, you know, we're not babysitting people's homes. So how do we go back and say, okay, now you've got to pay because we see so-and-so looks like they're 20 and not 80.
So a couple of things there. I think in the instance, the specific example you gave would be an ADU. And so the city could just completely exempt ADUs altogether, regardless of who's living in them.
Okay.
But your point is well taken that housing uses can change. And so if there is a, for example, a senior living community, where the idea behind it is that everyone there is 55 and older and kids under 18 aren't allowed to live there, then that's obviously not going to generate any students. And so there can be an exemption for that kind of use of property. However, in order to be entitled to that exemption, this ordinance would require a covenant to be recorded against that property that says you can only have, you know, 55 and overs, no 18 and unders living there. And if you do convert that property to a different use, then you have to pay impact fees at that time. And it's based on the fees that are adopted at that time. So 10 years down the road, the fees may be higher, but they'll be paying the impact fees at that time.
Question.
And just let me finish that off. You mentioned, you know, we don't babysit housing. You're right. But if somebody comes in to, you know, comply with our permitting regulations and, you know, discloses that they're making changes to the property or anything like that, then that is the time that we evaluate the use of the property and whether it still complies with.
Okay. Yes.
Councilmember De Leon.
Thank you. Yeah. So I've been listening and trying to take in all this really good walkthrough information. Could you walk me through a little bit more about the maybe the dynamics and maybe some of the precedent that's been set already about ADUs and impact fees for low-income houses? Like, are there different, is there a possibility of, say, different rates? Because I understand, you know, that might be a factor as well. They're probably smaller houses, et cetera. That said also, like, is it common that these fees or like any sort of related fees does get passed on to the residents versus say the builders themselves? Like, is that going to be something that would impact the cost of potentially more affordable housing? I ask also because I'm really hesitant right now until, you know, I'm happy to hear more information, but I'm very hesitant right now about any sort of school impact fee that would, I guess, let other residents kind of not pay for something that the whole community benefits from. So I'm curious to hear though, if there's going to be any sort of, like if other school districts or other cities have these kinds of allowances where we say, yes, we still charge fees for ADUs, or yes, we still do want to have some sort of literal buy-in for low-income units or for affordable senior housing, but is there a different rate or is that common?
So I'll walk you through some of the potential exemptions or waivers because I think that will cover the questions you were just posing. So if this doesn't answer your question, then we'll go back and we'll try again. So the model ordinance that I circulated earlier has a provision 3.70.110. That's what Councilmember Didi was just referring to. And actually I just had it on the screen a moment ago. There it is right there, 110, the exemptions. So we can walk through that. But right now, there is no exemption for ADUs, but it is a pretty common exemption. And Denise, the school district's attorney, actually sent me some language earlier today citing King County Code that exempts ADUs completely from impact fees. And there's, you know, since ADUs are becoming a more important and expanding source of affordable housing options, you know, that is certainly something that the council would be able to do, would be to just declare them exempt from impact fees altogether, particularly because right now the demographics of ADU inhabitants probably don't lend themselves to very many student generating, you know, not probably not generating many students out of ADU. So So we could just add a new category of exemption to 370. Well, that should say 100 or 110, not 100. Sorry, that's a typo. That just says accessory dwelling units as defined in BDMC 1856-010. That's our ADU code that have been legally permitted by the city. So anytime somebody has a legally permitted ADU, it's exempt. Knowing that times change and uses change and demographic shift and housing pattern shift, we could say, if the council was interested, that this code section could be reconsidered in the future if a school district were to present the city with reliable student generation data demonstrating that ADUs are in fact creating a significant need for additional school facilities. Right now, I don't think there's any data to support that. But if in the future that became a common thing, then we could revisit whether they really should be exempt or not from impact fees. But that is certainly something we could do. Councilmember Deedy, you are muted, but I'm happy to talk to you.
Well, if we exempt ADUs, so I'm just thinking of my own house. If I turned my walk-in basement into a living quarters, it could have three bedrooms, a kitchen, living room, and everything, and you know, house a family. Mm-hmm. So that would be an impact to the school.
Potentially.
But so if we exempt that, then the school would lose that money, but there would be still an impact. So I think that part would be definitely a good thing for the council to sit down at a work study or Zoom and discuss doing the exempt on ADUs. I think there's a whole myriad of possibilities there that, you know, could be pros and cons that would be good to look at.
Yeah.
I think one of the things we'd want to look at, right, is how our ADU rules limit the size and use, right? I think in the ADU there was some size limitations, right, Barb?
Right, 1,000 square feet.
Yeah, so that doesn't lead to a lot of additional student need, but it is possible. It's something to discuss.
And just to kind of close the loop on that conversation, I think that'd be a great conversation for the council to have. And, you know, anytime you want to have that conversation, that would be good. I would say that if you're interested in getting the ordinance adopted soon, we could adopt the ordinance and then have that as a subsequent amendment to add, you know, a few months down the road when you've figured out how to accommodate ADUs. Maybe we keep it silent on ADUs for now or not. But it could be that the ordinance gets adopted and then tweaked later, because those things get tweaked all the time. Or, I mean, you could hold off completely and not pass anything until you've got all the kinks worked out, but you could do it either way.
So Councilmember Deedy, so I think it would be, personally, I think it would be good to adopt it with the ADUs in, and then go forward with a work study and to, like you said, you know, tweak it a little bit or leave it as is, but have that discussion, because I think that, as you stated earlier, that there is a lot of construction going on in the city of Black Diamond. And the longer that we prolong this, the school district and our students are losing out on the needed funds. So my suggestion would be, you know, to leave the ADUs in and then move forward and then eventually go back and look at that portion.
Councilmember De Leon, do you have your hand up? Oh, yeah, you do.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. I'm concurring with Councilmember Deedy here. I think it's really important that any discussion that includes any potential increase in residents does have to have some sort of impact fee attached. It's just, to me, that's just the most responsible thing to do, especially when we're looking at a population where we're already really growing and seeing how much more, like our, you know, how much our schools are already underfunded as it is, to not at least address that there's potentially even more growth than originally accounted for just seems like the right approach. With that in mind, I would be open to say, you know, consider additional fees, an initial fee schedule for ADUs that's different than, say, a really large residential house or multi-unit family arrangements. But I'm definitely, and I guess my dog too, we're both very much in favor of at least including including those kinds of impact fees, including ADUs for this time.
Yeah, I would say that we'd have to look at a different schedule. I would agree, Councilmember De Leon, that if we want to include ADUs, because if we're going to put a $4,000 fee on an ADU permitting process, that's going to close down ADU permits, right? Because most of these ADUs we're getting aren't usually student generating, at least from the some of the discussions I've had. They're for grandma and grandma and that kind of stuff, right? They're redoing over the garage or in the basement or whatever. So I think a separate schedule for ADUs, if we're going to include ADUs, would make sense.
Good discussion.
I gotta chime in. I have another meeting that I gotta get into. Anything else happens, you guys, just please let me know an email.
Okay.
Appreciate you guys.
If I could, I just wanted to kind of weigh in on this ADU matter. And, you know, I guess I can see both sides of it. There's potential for abuse on that. But I think if you really look at most of the ADUs that are built, they're on property where there's an existing home and somebody's building a mother-in-law unit to take care of grandma or grandpa. And I would really hate to burden our residents with an additional school impact fee just to make that happen. So I really do think we need to talk about this subject matter a little bit more. Maybe a clearer definition of what actually constitutes an ADU, I think, would be helpful, at least for me. Maybe everybody else has a clear definition of it, but I don't.
So I agree with that, and goes back to my question earlier about how does the city monitor once a grandparent or parent is in an additional ADU, and then they're gone or they move out, and a younger or family moves in and that home never paid any impact fees. So I think, you know, that's again something that needs to be discussed during a work study just on this alone, because I think it's pretty, it's got a lot of questions to it. So I think moving on from this at this point would be good, and then just schedule a work study on it after we pass the impact fees.
I think one thing that's important to remember is that our ADU regulation is 1,000 feet, right? So we're not talking a big four bedroom ADU, right? We're talking maybe a one bedroom, two bedroom kind of setup for grandma, grandpa kind of thing. So I
want to go back to the earlier point made about the concept of a burden. I think it is important to be thinking about what kind of burdens we might be putting on our residents. But that also means that I would ask us to think about burden versus benefit. And whenever there's a burden, whom are we burdening the most? And when we already do have these class sizes that are getting enormous, and I have worked in buildings where there have been over 40 students per classroom, I find that to be quite a burden for everybody involved, you know, school personnel, as well as the students and ultimately their families. Any sort of, you know, way that we can help to mitigate that kind of issue is, I think, going to be, you know, actually overall reducing that burden and increasing the benefit to our community. I mean, for me personally, no, that maybe if it is, you know, grandma, grandpa kind of thing living in a house, no, that's not generating additional students at the time being. Of course, with housing affordability, I see it being more and more going towards younger families. But, you know, even if that's the case, again, we are all a community here. And
for me, it just seems incredibly important that whatever stage of life we're at, we're still supporting these kind of institutions like our schools that are ultimately helping us all. I don't every day drive on every single road in Black Diamond, but I know that if we make sure that all those roads are taken care of, more people benefit, right? So I'd be very hesitant to exclude ADUs entirely from this. Also, I do know from working with, again, with my past in education, that there are many families that have no other choice than to share small dwelling spaces, smaller than they would find ideal, just because of the cost of housing. Again, that's where I kind of go back to that original question of making sure that any impact fee isn't disproportionately passed on to those residents. But I would really caution against thinking of any sort of fee attached to supporting our local schools as being a burden, when I think it's the exact opposite. It's not taking care of our schools that is very likely to be that burden.
Well, I think if we focus on implementing the school impact fees for homes first, that would probably be a good start.
So, Councilmember Oglesby here. So, yeah, Chris DeLeon, I do agree. You know, I look at this when we say we're excluding the low-income housings and ADU. When we're talking about low-income houses and ADUs, I would imagine that kind of clumps together. So when you're saying the ADUs might be only so many square feet, you maybe might get a mom and maybe a daughter in there, you're still providing a low income ADU for that family to live in. So if the low income housing is going to have a separate fee on that, I guess I would like to even, and I agree with Steve right here saying, how much burden are we going to put on those ADUs and those extra families that are struggling for low income families? But again, it sounds like this might be a conversation later to discuss in a work study, because it sounds like we have a lot of passionate feelings about the ADUs and impact fees. So I say let's continue with this work study on the school impact fees first.
One note I would say that, you know, we have to remember that this is an impact fee. The property tax payments towards the school is not impacted, right? So they're going to still get property tax for that property. And if they add an ADU, their assessment will go up and they'll pay an additional property tax every year. So what we don't want to do is put ourselves in a way where we are actually disincentivizing the building of ADUs for our senior population or our lower income population, right? Because that, Council Member Didi was just saying, is a lot of those ADUs are for folks who are lower income because our housing is so expensive around here. So I think that's a good thing to keep in mind, right? We're not removing any contribution. We are just not adding to an impact fee that may have no impact at all to the school.
All right, well, that low income comment, I was picking low impact development here. Low income housing comment is a good segue to our next slide. So good job, Councilmember Wazowski. So the ADUs could actually kind of fall under two different categories, because another option that the council has is to incorporate a low income housing exemption. It would go in the same area. I put a placeholder in there for now under 3.70.110G. But that low-income housing piece can take a couple of different forms. RCWs provide the city with authority to grant an exemption for low-income housing. The statute says that up to 80% of the school impact fee can be waived. And actually it says that a full waiver, a full 100% can be waived for low-income housing. But that typically leaves the school districts in the not great position of then having to plug that gap, that extra 20% gap, with other capital funding available to them. If you do grant an exemption for low-income housing, this is sort of the police mechanism, Councilmember Redina, that you had talked about before. A restrictive covenant has to be recorded against that property that says it can only be used for low-income housing. And if it's ever converted to another use, impact fees are owed at that time. This kind of exemption also requires school district input and approval. If you don't get to go hog wild and just come up with wild and crazy solutions that don't serve the school district's needs at all, we'll want to consult with the school districts and make sure that they've had an opportunity to provide input and explain why what the council is doing either would work or would not work or might have some issues. And then lastly, low income is actually a defined term in the statute. So I know that we have a few provisions in our current code that are intended to help out low income situations, like with our utility lifeline and things of that nature. This would come with its own separate definition of what low income means in the context of impact fees. And what it means is that the housing would have a monthly housing expense that is no greater than 30% of 80% of the median family income within the county. So I think where that comes from is if you take the median family income in King County, 80% and below of that is considered low income, and your housing expense in theory is supposed to be no greater than 30% of your gross income. So that's where you get the 30% of 80% of the median. And so that's how that would be calculated. But it would be up to the builder, up to the developer who's applying for an exemption or trying to claim an exemption, to demonstrate that the project that is being built comes within this low income threshold, and it's on the developer to provide a recorded lien against the property, a recorded covenant against the property to ensure that it is only used for those purposes. Councilmember De Leon.
Yeah, so question about that then, to go back to a fee or a potential partial waiver of for low-income housing. Is there any provision or any law that can make sure then that any builder paying this fee doesn't in some way pass it on to the residents? And if that's a possibility, what would that look like? Is there anything like in place to do that?
It's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. Certainly something I can look into. I don't know if any of our school district representatives or Denise, if you have any insight that you could share on that topic, be happy to do that. Sure. Otherwise, figure it out later.
Yeah, what I can generally speak to is that when a builder is paying its permit fees, whether it's school impact fees, traffic impact fees, building permit related fees, I think it's probably a fair assumption that they are building all of those costs into the price of the home. And so while the homeowner is not paying them directly, when you look at the total cost of the home, it is in consideration of whatever the builder has put into their product, including all of their related permit fees. And then, of course, they have their profit margin that they look to. And so I think that it's probably not accurate to say that fees aren't passed on to the homeowner. They certainly aren't passed on directly, but indirectly in the cost of the home. Now, the flip side would be the value of the home that they're receiving and the equity that they build over time. I think there is a little bit of give and take there. That's probably not a direct answer, but there's certainly nothing in law that prohibits a builder from, setting what the market will bear in terms of the price of a home.
So to follow up on that question then, I'm curious what it might look like then, or what your experience might be about that filling in the gap. What has it been like in your school district when we do have a waiver, and then we're talking about finding some other ways to fund it? Is it through a levy, or walk us through that a little bit?
Yeah, more. Sure. So early on in the presentation, David talked about the state law requirement that impact fees cannot pay the full costs of a growth-related capacity improvement. They are a piece of the puzzle for funding. And the reality for all school districts is that the primary source of funding school buildings comes from local bonds. The entire taxpayers bear the burden of the school facilities. And then, of course, there are components of state funding that come into play. And the purpose of impact fees under the Growth Management Act is to offset some of that burden on the existing community. So the existing community is not paying the full costs of growth, and some of that is shifted to the new growth. And so when you saw the graphic of the formula, David noted that there were components for state funding and tax credits, tax payments, and those are actually credits that are levied against the cost per dwelling unit, so that there is a recognition that there are other funding sources coming into play. But in addition to those other funding sources, there is a charge for new development related to its impact. So that's how all of that works together. But the bottom line is that the lion's share does come from those local bond issues. And where there are exemptions, those other funding sources tend to be the local bond dollars.
Great, thank you so much. It's nice to have somebody who knows what she's talking about on the call rather than just me.
You're doing a good job, David.
Thank you.
David?
Yes, Councilman Didi.
On exemptions, I just have this thought, you know, I could just picture Barb at the counter and somebody coming in and saying, look, I've raised my kids, I'm 60 years old. I don't know what the exempt age is right now. So I'm downsizing from my 3,200 square foot home, and I'm now going to build a 2,000 square foot home on my property next to me. And I'm not going to have any kids. I've raised them all, so I should be exempt, right? So I mean, what, you know, anybody that's a senior is exempt? Or you have to show that you're low income, or you have to show that you're building another dwelling unit on a piece of your property for your parent or a loved one, excuse me. I guess I just don't understand the whole exemption for elderly on some form, you know.
Right. So the example you gave of somebody kind of moving out of their larger home and building a smaller home next door, I can't remember if that is in the definitions, if that's covered in the definitions of development activity, or if that's one of the exemptions. Here I'm just scrolling through the, so a development activity means any residential construction or expansion, change in use, or the change in use of land that creates additional demand for school facilities. So I think there'd be an argument in that situation where if somebody is just sort of downsizing himself into a smaller house on his same lot, that may not trigger an impact fee payment. It would kind of depend on what happened with the house that he was living in. If a family of four moved in, he probably wouldn't be able to fit within the carve out for development that doesn't have any impact. But I was thinking there was something in the exemptions as well that spoke to that.
Yeah, I couldn't find anything, so that's why I asked.
David, while you're looking, I'll just kind of speak, if it's okay, bit to that. The senior housing exemption, is the purpose of it really is in recognition of where there is new housing that is dedicated exclusively for adults over a certain age with no children ever going to live in those units. And this tends to be planned communities for the most part. So there are specific communities like Trilogy, for example, out in Redmond Ridge, where it is designed and intended only for 55 plus or 62 plus. And so the key on those, of course, is that in order to be able to take advantage of that exemption, you record the restrictive covenant on the property that limits that housing in perpetuity to adults only. And if there is ever a conversion, then an impact fee would be paid. Now, those covenants, like you said, it's hard to babysit everyone. There are enforceability provisions where, let's say that the school district notices, gosh, we're suddenly getting a lot of students getting on the bus right outside of this senior community. They know the addresses of their students, and you know, there could be an enforceability issue through that mechanism, but it's not foolproof. And so that is really the purpose of that senior housing exemption, is not necessarily on a case-by-case basis as people move into a new, build a new home and seek to apply it. They certainly could come to the city and ask to do that, but they would have to really understand that the intention is that that home forevermore will only be used for age 62 and above.
So that makes sense. So, because I just thought, what a whole nother mess to put on the city for people to come in and say, look, I don't have any kids. I'm not going to do an impact fee or an impact on the school. So I should be qualified for the exemption. And I think what you just said, that, you know, your home could be at any time transitioned into a family dwelling, that it needs to have the impact fees. Now, if you're moving into, let's say, you know, right now we have 10 Trails planning on building I think it's 55 and older home area, then that would be exempt, because that in perpetuity, or however you say that, would be strictly for seniors. And then that would be exempt. So that totally makes sense. So I just, you know, I just thought, man, how is Barb and the community development going to explain and try to justify why they have to pay it and so-and-so doesn't? So that was perfect. Thank you.
So I want to go back to an original point that was made earlier about enforceability. And I think that is really key to look at in this case. There are plenty of folks who, for a variety of reasons, choose to use alternate addresses when they're going to and from school. And that could be just as simple as daycare related issues and making sure that there's childcare, right? And I could see that there would be a purpose for especially senior housing, and of course the cost of, childcare being, you know, just exponentially growing. I could see that coming into place. And then with that in mind, I could see there being this very uncomfortable level of how we are choosing to enforce it or not, that could get us into some kind of strange places. So I would kind of have us keep that in mind, that there might be some cases where it turns into some sort of, you know, housing accommodation, especially if someone's moving in there. It could be, you know, I just want us to consider that a little bit. But with that in mind too, and to go back to the point of some very city specific cases, we're talking about the 10 Trails Senior Living Development, the planned community there, which is not going to be a low-income senior housing development. It's going to be higher end. And to me, it seems only fair that, again, this is going back to that we are buying into a community, and it's only natural that we're supporting each other in this. Even if the seniors who live there, or those who are, you know, who are living there, go there and maybe don't send kids to school there, this is just how we make sure that we are providing for an institution that once upon a time they benefited from, and it's quite possible that their grandchildren are now benefiting from. So really, let's keep that in mind, and also incentivizing. If we do incentivize this and we're incentivizing senior living communities, that's great. We want to make sure that we have also affordable places for for seniors to live. Not sure if 10 Trails counts for that or what's being planned there, but we do want to incentivize it, but at what expense, and who are we leaving out of it? And that would include, you know, other communities and those who might also be planning to work in Black Diamond, if we're also planning more commercial and industrial spaces as well. All these are important to keep in mind, but to me, the bottom line is, if you choose to buy into the community, you should be buying into the community. So I'm really all for having the school impact fees not completely exempt certain, neighborhoods from it. We can consider other rates, but to say, oh, well, you're of this age, so you don't have to pay into something that benefits us all, seems, doesn't seem like the most responsible choice. So that's what I think I would go back to on that, or those three points, with enforceability, incentivizing, and keeping in mind that a lot of what we're talking about are buildings that can probably stand to pay a little bit more into something that is already supposed to entice younger communities to live in.
So Councilmember Didi, so on that line of Christiana De Leon's statement about Tentrils, I know quite a few seniors who have looked into that, and yes, they cannot afford to live in that portion of the senior housing part in there. But my worry would be then that we're discriminating against one senior housing development versus another. And so I think maybe this goes right back to our work study, I think, that we look into that and figure out, you know, is there ever going to be another senior housing development other than the one off of Baker Street and the one in Ten Trails? And yeah. And how do we balance both of those? Because one is obviously King County affordable housing, and the one at Ten Trails is going to be quite more expensive. It's going to be a more luxury, I think, place for seniors to retire that can afford it. So I think during the work study, we'll have to sit down, have that discussion, figure out if ADUs are going to be applied. You know, King County Housing is going to start putting in, I think, 25 homes out there. So once we get this going, and like I said before, then we can come back to the ADUs, the exemption, and figure all that out.
My one quick point on that is I am really glad that we're hashing some of this out now, or at least having these preliminary discussions while we do have so many stakeholders on this call right now, you know, members of different, you know, school boards and also members of the community. So, you know, I understand we're probably not going to go through a lot tonight or have everything worked out tonight, but I really do appreciate that we're taking this time to talk about this when there are already so many both residents and school employee stakeholders and representatives of the school board on this call, and really thank them for being here too.
Yeah, this was definitely intended to be as much of a brainstorming session as, you know, as anything else, not maybe to reach any decisions, but certainly to get your feedback, give you an opportunity to answer questions, explore some of these concepts. I think you've already identified a couple of great topics for our work study down the road. And just to close the loop, Councilmember Deedy, on your question about, you know, the guy coming into the permit desk and saying, I should be exempt for my house. There actually is one provision in the code in this proposed ordinance that allows a builder to come in and try and demonstrate. This is under 3.70.120D. Unusual circumstances that if the standard impact fee amount were applied to the development, it would be unjust or unfair. So there is some opportunity for very unique circumstances to be presented to the city for a decision about whether an impact fee is unjust or unfair in that specific case. And there's also an opportunity for an appeal if to the hearing examiner, if for whatever reason the builder was dissatisfied with the ultimate determination.
Okay. Yeah, I was just going to ask you who would make that determination. Would it be the city staff, Barb and her team, or would it then come to council and council say, but I think that it's best that it goes to Barb and her team, and then if somebody doesn't like the outcome, they take it straight to the hearing examiner.
Yeah. So the general rules for these exemptions require that the district, you know, they get to have some say-so in this, in how these get crafted. But the actual decision, applying it to specific cases, I believe would typically be handled by the community development director.
I think Barb had her hand up a minute ago. We missed what she had to say.
Yeah, I don't have everybody on my screen at the same time, so I can't always see everyone's hands.
Oh, thank you, Councilmember Stout. I just was, Councilmember Deedy was talking about senior housing units. And we have another one under review right now, the one across from the Lake Sewer Grocery. So right, senior housing projects are a thing outside of Ten Trails. I just wanted to say, yep, there's another one out there.
That's right, I forgot about that one.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. I realize that's more on the Kent side. Correct me if I'm wrong, but thank you for bringing that one up.
And Denise, is what I just said correct, that typically the actual application of the ordinance to a specific situation is always handled by the city staff. It doesn't really come to the district for an appeal or for guidance or
anything. Yeah, like that is correct. And it really reflects that the city staff who are, you know, working through the permit system and really understand the development are really in the best position to be able to interpret and apply.
Yeah. Okay, great. All right, I think we've already talked about the Auburn situation a bit and the sliding scale and how that kind of concept could be applied to certain types of situations unique to Black Diamond. Another area where the council has some discretion, we've touched on this before, administrative costs for collecting, tracking, and remitting the impact fees to the districts, as well as administrative costs for processing impact fee deferrals. As I mentioned, a deferral option is something that state law requires cities to give to builders. It says, you know, rather than paying your impact fees when you pull the building permit, you can defer payment of the fee until a future date. And the statute allows for three different dates. You can either do it at final inspection, at certificate of occupancy, or upon first sale. But if a builder is going to take advantage of that deferral opportunity, he has to record a lien against the property. And then when that event occurs and the impact fees are paid, then the city can release the lien. And so all that takes administrative time and burden on the city. And so it's typical that a city charges a deferral administration fee. And I think the version of the ordinance that I circulated had a $200 fee associated with that. And I believe that's fairly standard.
So I personally don't think that we should defer payment at occupancy, and maybe city attorney or anybody else can answer that question of why it's good or bad. But I just think that if you defer that payment till occupancy, then the city really has no control. I mean, you can then do what you just stated. You can then put a lien on the property to get that. So I would think it would be better to take that money either up front or have that second option at final inspection, maybe.
Yeah, just to be clear, the certificate of occupancy option doesn't mean you grant the certificate of occupancy and then you ask for the fee. It's you withhold the occupancy until they pay the fee.
Okay.
Just a different time. It's a little bit later in the process is all.
Okay. Then that makes sense.
But I think you're right. The school districts would rather have the money earlier rather than later. And I think the most common choice here is that earlier stage of building of final inspection, when the deferral, that's as late as the deferral will be permitted in a lot of cities. So,
yeah, and I think final inspection would be the one I would go for, you know, and get that final payment, and then be done with that development as far as collecting fees.
Yep. That would be consistent, I think, with the most common practice would be the deferral option being only until final inspection.
Okay.
Boy, you've asked a lot of questions, so this slide may be pointless, but
I would just say maybe check on that.
So I have a question. Well, really, just on 3.70.060 on impact fee program elements.
Okay, which one was that? 060?
Yep.
Great, let's get
on A. Here.
Yep.
It's just a word thing that just kind of bothered me, but I mean, whatever. The city shall impose impact fees on every development. Should it say the city shall impose impact fees on all development instead of every?
It certainly could. There's a definition for development activity. That's what this is referring to. That's what's incorporating here. So yeah, the idea is that all development activity is potentially subject to impact fees. So I think maybe every suggests more of individual developments, but yeah, either one I think would be fine.
Okay. So it's up to you guys. I just reading that, I kept changing that every to all. So I'm good. I think that this was a great discussion.
Yeah, really good discussion.
And I think, you know, we have some work to do on the exemption, ADUs. But other than that, I'm good with finally getting this on the agenda soon. Yeah. And getting it going.
And you'll get some more public input, presumably on August 6th when it's up for a public hearing.
Yeah. Perfect. So I make a motion to adjourn if there's no more discussion.
We want to, is there anybody on the line from the school districts who wants to have a final word or thoughts to share?
The only thing that I would say is I do excuse me for my absence there for a moment, but I do appreciate just the thoughtful comments and the thoughtful discussion about matters that will definitely impact the school district of Enumclaw or the Enumclaw School District. And so thank you so very much, council members, for allowing me to participate.
And while we're still here, I just wanted to once again more officially extend a welcome. And it's nice to cyber meet you, new Superintendent Carey. And I think what I read from your bio is that you're a fellow Lute, so go Lutes. Yeah, fantastic. All right. Well, yeah, let's talk more and keep in touch. And thank you so much for being here.
So we have a motion to adjourn. Do I have a second?
Second.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
All right. Motion, meeting adjourned.